have our third case today, Thor, Thayer?
Steve Thayer.
Thayer, thank you. Steve Thayer versus LIRC. John Becker, Racine, arguing for Mr. Thayer. Yes, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, or good afternoon, Your Honors. Without getting into a lot of detail, basically what this case is about is when an employee is injured, what is included in the average weekly wage for computing the temporary disability. Mr. Thayer was injured, and it's a very clear-cut case here because there's no dispute that he had an injury, there's no dispute about the time that he was off of work, there's no dispute about what his wage was absent the health insurance. There was not even a factual finding at the time of the hearing. Everything was stipulated to. The whole transcript was 9 pages long. The only issue is, should health insurance be included in that computation? And the starting point in this analysis is really to look at the statute. And it's not a long statute, and to me, I believe it's very clear and to the point. The statute says, where any things of value are received in addition to monetary earnings, as part of the wage contract, they shall be deemed a part of earnings and computed at the value thereof to the employee. And in reading the defendant's briefs, as I read their briefs, there's nothing in the second half of that statute that they are disputing. There's two different things in the first half that they seem to have questions about. One is things of value. What is a thing of value? Is health insurance a thing of value? And the second thing that they seem to question about the statute, or they seem to claim the creates an ambiguity in the statute, is whether the health insurance was received by the employee. Well, the first part is whether or not health insurance is a thing of value. In all three defendants' briefs, I could not find one of them at any point in time say health insurance is not a thing of value. They said, well, it has to be a tangible or taxable thing of value. It's not a thing of value under the statute. But none of them have come out and said health insurance is not a thing of value. And I think anybody would be pretty hard-pressed to say that health insurance is not a thing of value.
Well, is this a premium that's paid?
The health insurance was included. I mean, the employer paid the health insurance on behalf of the employee. When he was off, they continued his insurance for 90 days, and then he had to pay $626.
And the 90 days was basically part of the contractual arrangement that they would pay for 90 days. Beyond that, that's the question.
Correct. They agreed to pay for 90 days.
How did they calculate the 626 or whatever it was?
He got a notice. Whenever health insurance is cut off, the employee will get a notice saying if you want to continue your insurance under, I guess, a COBRA.
Maybe I asked the question, okay. The wrong question. Is that the amount that the employer paid for the health insurance of its employees?
I'm not 100% sure if that's the amount they paid. Mr. Akowitz had a breakdown at the hearing that $91 of it was for administrative costs, $500-some was for the actual insurance, but the total premium, the total amount that he would have had to pay to continue his insurance was $626.
Yeah, but the reason I ask, of course, is because if we're talking about, what are the magic words here, actual or wages, AWW, average weekly wage, including anything of value, well, you know, do we compute that value, if you prevail, do they compute that value based upon what the employer paid, or do they compute that value based upon what the employee will have to pay?
Well, I think in this case, it would be based on what the employee would have to pay.
Why? If he hasn't been paid, if the employer hasn't been paying that? What if the employer's got a group health plan where the employer only has to pay $200 a month?
Well, let me address that in two different ways, and I don't mean to be avoiding your question here, but that, first of all, goes to what the value is, not whether or not the value should be included. If the value is included, and there is some dispute about what should be included, that would be a factual determination the department would have to make at some point. Whether the $525 they were paying or it should be $625, that's really a factual question which would have to be decided if there was a dispute about that at the time of the hearing. The real issue today, though, is should the value of what he receives, whatever the department determines that value to be, should that be included in the average weekly wage?
Isn't this something that should be, since this was bargained, shouldn't it be bargained for? What happens?
Well, no.
Why not?
Okay, because here's why. And I think the trial court actually missed the point on this also. The trial court, in its decision, said that the department's interpretation was reasonable. The applicant's interpretation was reasonable. He gave the department's interpretation due weight and said, well, it's both sides are reasonable, therefore he accepted the department's interpretation. Here's why I disagree with that. Because this is not a question of, if we started from scratch and said we're going to pass a statute and now we want to decide what we should include. Should we include health insurance in average weekly wage? Well, there's reasons not to include it. It may be costly, it may be hard to compute. There are reasons to include it. It's very, you know, the employee needs it when they're off of work. This is when they need it the most. So there are reasons on both sides. Both arguments are reasonable. That's not the question. The question is the interpretation of this statute. There was an advisory council back in 1937. This is what they agreed to. Mr. Saxe, I believe, goes to these meetings with the advisory council, and as I understand, they come to loggerheads. You have an equal number of labor and management on each side. Last year, they couldn't even agree to raise the permanent partial disability rate for the first time since 1951. So you may never get to something done. Something was done in 1937. They passed a statute that said things of value, anything of value is included, and the question now is to interpret that statute.
But since that time, and based on, I think we had that booklet here, there has never been a decision which would include this in the AWW, right?
I'm not aware of any times that they've been asked to apply it.
Well, but they determine the wage maybe every day in a whole variety of cases. I mean,
the department.
The department.
Oh, sure. I've been practicing for almost 20 years. Workers' comp, almost the whole time. This is the only case where the wage has ever been in dispute. It's not something that's disputed that often. Very often the parties, in almost all cases, they stipulate to what the wage is.
And what do they stipulate to? What's shown on the paycheck?
It depends. That's what it usually is. But I can't say what it is in other cases. But usually there isn't a dispute.
And how many of those cases do you think there's the health insurance paid in whole or part by the employer? The last 20 years.
There's probably been some. But I can tell you, personally, I didn't take the cases up because there may have been other issues clouding it. This was a very clean case in terms of this issue. So this is a case that I wanted to bring up. There are other cases where I could have. I just chose not to. And there's a lot of different reasons. When you look at this case alone, if Mr. Toyer prevails, his average weekly wage will go up by $150 a week approximately, and we're talking $3,600 for 6 months, of which he gets two-thirds of that, so it's $2,400. So from each individual case, it doesn't amount to a lot of money, so there's a lot of reasons why this case or this issue may not have been in front of this court before. It may just not have been worth anybody's time to take it up.
But here, we took this on certification, and as I recall reading the commentary or what the Court of Appeals sent, they indicated that this would be a very costly decision, costly in the sense that it isn't just this case, as you know, and you're saying within your experience you don't know, but in looking at all of the other cases around the state that you have looked at, you've been practicing for 20 years, the impression I'm getting that you're not aware of any case out there that would have included this in the AWW as it's been interpreted by the commission at any time.
The only two cases I'm aware of are the two that are attached to my appendix where the ALJs in both cases said that it should be included. I've probably had cases where I could have made the claim but I didn't because for various reasons, or maybe there just wasn't enough to fight about. May have been clouded by other issues.
Are you done?
Yes, go ahead.
This is a big case.
Yes.
I take it your position would be
that the ball doesn't stop with just health premiums. The next case is going to be maybe even Social Security, retirement plans, other fringe benefits. Is it your position that anything of value, including anything of the fringe benefits, are within the statute, or can we draw the line somewhere? If we allow this, are we opening up a box that we can't close?
I think you're opening up a box, but I don't think it's unlimited. First of all, the Department of Defendants argue that it's difficult to calculate. Well, I don't think it's that hard to calculate. It's a lot easier to calculate what it costs for health insurance than it does for a meal plan or for lodging or other things which they can see are included in this statute. Employers know how much it costs them to hire a new employee. For example, if I hire two secretaries and I'm willing to pay $15 an hour for that job, and one says, my husband has insurance, my kids are out of the house, give me the $15. And the other one says, well, I'm getting married, I'm going to start a family, I'll take $10 an hour, give me $3 an hour in health insurance and $2 an hour in other types of benefits. It costs me $15 an hour for each of those positions. If they get hurt, if they both develop carpal tunnel and can't work, the first one would get two-thirds of $15 an hour. The second one would get two-thirds of $10 an hour. It's not that hard to compute what it costs you for an employee. Whatever that package of benefits is, it is.
Yes, but the other side of that coin is that these, in many instances, and I take it here, these have been bargained for. And part of the understanding of management, anyway, has been that the long-standing application of this statute is, as found in the Workers' Compensation Manual, that meals for cost, fringe benefits, etc., are disregarded. So we're not starting from scratch here. Because in your example, you're starting from scratch. One gets 15, one gets 10. That, as you well know, is not the case. How do you handle that? I mean, you open up this box, this is a huge, huge cost.
Again, I don't know how they rate the insurance. I mean, I don't know. But I can tell you, that, again, as an employer, if I pay my first secretary $15 an hour, and the other one comes in and says, I'll take the $15 an hour, I mean, to me, it doesn't matter. And if they both get hurt, it just doesn't make any sense to me that one's temporary disability rate should be less. I mean, two-thirds less, or whatever it happens to be. They're doing the same job, they're getting the same compensation package, they're just paid in different forms.
Mr. Becker, if I might follow up with what Justice Babbage was getting at, and I don't think I ever really heard an answer, where do you draw the line here? If you say health insurance benefits, that has to be included in the average weekly wage. What about life insurance? What about disability coverage? What about pension? How do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line, if any place?
You don't necessarily draw it at any particular point.
Again, so in other words, what we're really talking about is all fringe benefits.
For the most part, that would be true.
Okay, what level of deference do we owe to Lurk here?
I believe you owe no deference.
This is just a de novo situation?
I believe so. To me, it's a strictly interpretation of the statute. Again, this is not a mixed question of law and fact. They've suggested that it is, but they haven't suggested what the question of fact is. Again, as I mentioned, the transcript was 9 pages long, and it was all stipulated to. It's strictly a question of law.
I hate to interrupt, but in that same area, under the UFE case, which was recent, I was on the court. Didn't the court say that we always give deference to an administrative agency's interpretation of this statute? In this case, at least it might be entitled to due deference.
I agree. I understand what you say. And if that is, I mean, there is language that says if the agency is charged with administering the statute, you can give that their decision due deference. If that is the case, and if you're going to do that here, my feeling is come out and say we're never going to apply it, didn't overstand the review in a workers' comp case. Because the workers' comp division is charged with administering a statute, but if that's the standard, there never will be a de novo standard of review.
Yesterday we had a case here involving a plant closing. And that case had a statutory provision, and that case had some administrative regulations. And there was concern that the administrative regulation, I think it dealt with the shift of the burden to the buyer, liability to the buyer in the plant closing. And there was concern that that administrative regulation was imposing liability and limitations where the statute didn't. Let's look at the statute here. What did the legislature intend by this statute? Then I want to ask whether or not if the interpretation of the agency limits what was given by the statute, is that interpretation owed deference? So, first of all, let's start with legislative intent. Tell me what you think this and why you think health insurance is covered under a thing of value.
Okay.
What did the legislature intend? That's where I want to start.
Okay.
And this was in 1937?
I think the legislature intended to include whatever the compensation package was.
That was the 16th Amendment. That was probably in the late... That's the one that dealt with taxes, you know?
That was... Yeah.
That was probably... I don't know.
That was 1916, I think. I'm not a tax expert.
Well, there's some symmetry, huh? Okay, so as I understand it, the interpretation by the department takes the federal tax code and uses that, is it taxable, as part of their interpretation. But I want to start with, what did the legislature intend when it passed this legislation in 1937? What did it intend thing of value to mean?
Okay. I believe that they intended to include whatever the compensation package was. You pay an employee whatever it is. You can pay them in any form that you want. But whatever that total package is, if they get hurt, that's what they're going to be missing out on if they're off of work, and that's what the average weekly wage should be based
on. Are you relying on plain meaning? Or what's...
Yes.
Okay, you're saying thing of value.
Thing of value means just that.
Okay, so you don't have to... You're not looking at anything other than the plain meaning of the statute to discern what the legislature intended in 1937 when it passed it, right?
Correct. Correct. I mean, they suggested it should be tangible and taxable. There's nothing in the statute that says it has to be tangible or taxable. Matter of fact, their examples suggest that the legislature at that time did not intend to restrict it to that. They cite a footnote that talks about including apprenticeship instruction, which they concede was an intangible benefit. Well, what their interpretation of the statute would be, it's ambiguous if you try to interpret it their way, because their interpretation would result in saying, where anything's of value, as determined by the department, are received in addition to monetary earnings, they shall be deemed part of the wage contract, or in part of the earnings. That's the way they want you to interpret the statute. There is a reasonable person could look at this and read it and say, yeah, anything I get from my employer as part of my compensation would be included. If you don't interpret it that way, you're just going to be guessing at what it means. Again, you would have to rewrite the statute to say, where anything's of value, they're tangible and taxable. Anything's that are value, if you could try to limit it some other way, because you can't limit it even to that, even under their analysis. Because even with the examples they use, there are some intangible benefits that are included. So I don't even know how they would rewrite the statute. They'd rewrite the whole thing, I guess, but...
Could I ask you a question?
Sure.
What does the term wage contract mean?
The wage contract you have with your employer, it can be, if I'm hired individually by one person, there's still a wage contract. There's an employment contract, may not be written, or you may have a union contract. I mean, there may be a union, that may be a wage contract. So it's whatever the agreement is between the employer and the employee.
You're saying that all employees have a wage contract?
Sure. Okay. Assuming they're getting wages or paid, which I assume they are.
Well, it may not be a written contract.
Correct.
It may be a contract only for an hour.
It may be.
Or at will.
No doubt. Many of them are at will. But there's still a wage contract. There's a contract of employment there.
Well, it seems to me what you're saying is that this department interpretation is unreasonable. So even if you give it great weight deference, it's unreasonable. And it's unreasonable because one of the standards for an unreasonableness in looking at department interpretation is that it contravenes the words of the statute.
Correct.
In that you can give it all the deference you want. That's what you should be saying.
I believe that. You can give it great deference, and I still think that their conclusion is wrong.
And, well, it's because it contravenes the statute. Because the statute said things of value in addition to monetary earnings. So they're viewing you're going to get cash, check, whatever. But that you're going to get more than that. Or you might get more than that.
Correct.
So, and in light of that, what difference does it make with that you put in a lot of things? What about Social Security payments? You think that's a thing of value?
Social Security, yeah, I mean, maybe that might not be, that may be considered a tax, so you may not consider the employer's contribution for Social Security. But again, like, I put in 15% for my secretary at the end of the year. If I pay her $30,000 a year and I contribute 15% to a pension plan, and she's off for a year, she hasn't lost $30,000. She lost $34,500. So, yeah, I don't think you're limited to health insurance. There are other benefits that are included. So my warning light is on. Does that mean I...
You've got about 5 minutes, roughly.
Okay. Means we can ask you more questions.
Sure.
What would be the policy implications of your winning this case?
The policy implications? That employees such as Mr. Tour, who is off of work, who already had his wages cut by one-third, wouldn't have to pay 43% of those benefits just to maintain his health insurance. I mean, when you look at the numbers here, 43% of what he was getting in workers' comp benefits, which, like I say, have already been reduced by one-third, would have had to go to cover his health insurance. And these are people who are already off of work with less income. I mean, they're the ones who need it the most. They're the ones, you know, if their families get sick, they need to go to the doctor, they don't have that insurance anymore.
Well, if we adopted your position, then, I mean, which would include this, I'm just saying that it would be a real incentive for a company to get the cheapest health insurance they can, wouldn't it? I mean, health insurance varies from company to company depending upon what package you picked up. You have the Cadillac plan, I'm sure you have the Zuzu plan, not to denigrate any automobiles, but you have the different plans out there, and you would have all kinds of different plans, as you do now.
Sure, that's true, and you do now. And there's still the incentive on the employer to get the cheapest. It's still going to save them the most money. But if the union or whoever has contracts for a better plan, that's something between them and the union. But that incentive is still there, even regardless of this decision.
Is this the proper subject of collective bargaining? And if so, has it ever been collectively bargained?
My understanding is that they talk about this at these meetings all the time at the advisory council. But again, I think Mr. Saxe pointed out you have an equal member of labor and management on this committee, and they're at loggerheads and they can't come to any agreement.
Well, I'm asking, is it a proper subject of collective bargaining? Could union ABC go to management of XYZ when they're bargaining their contracts? Include, notwithstanding any interpretation of this statute, the following shall be included in determining workers' compensation.
I don't think so. I mean,
a proper subject?
I don't believe it is. I know on workers' comp, even if you sign an agreement giving up your rights are still protected in workers' comp. You can't give up any rights under workers' comp unless there's a compromise agreement signed and approved by the department. I don't know that it necessarily would be subject to collective bargaining.
But maybe the employer can add to it and say, over and above workers' comp, we're going to give you ABC.
Oh, and some companies do. Some companies have a disability plan that pays 100% or 80% or whatever for a certain period of time. Certainly they can bargain for something like that.
I think my question is, what What would be the impact on workers' compensation insurance, the costs? How would carriers contemplate what the cost was going to be if this is sort of open-ended?
Well, I know I get audited every year from my workers' comp, and you have to indicate how much you pay in wages. And if this is included in wages, they're going to factor it into their cost of doing business. You know, is it going to add to the cost of insurance? It could.
Well, if you prevail here, your client would get, what, about 20% more? 25% more?
His insurance would have been about an extra $150 a week if he prevails. He would get...
About 25%.
About an extra $100, right, right.
The premiums right. reflect at least that.
Right. Ideally, what would happen is the council would get together and come up with some sort of agreement to continue to provide insurance, because even adding it to the average weekly wage only gives them two-thirds of it, and he's still going to be left short. And maybe this would be an incentive for them to come to some agreement, but, again, I have no control over them. So.
Okay, council, that's a happy note from the right. to end. You have five minutes in rebuttal. The way I have the lineup, Mr. Sabota, representing LERP, has 15 minutes. Mr. Okowitz has 10 minutes. Mr. Soxie, representing the Amicus Wisconsin Manufacturers, has 5. Right? Okay. Council?
My name is Stephen M. Sabota, Assistant Attorney General, and I am representing the respondent, Labor and Industry Review Commission. I realize our time is short this afternoon, Your Honors, and so if I can kind of cut to the chase, as they say, when Mr. Becker says that the respondents look at 102.11.1e and focus in on certain things, I want to make it clear that the respondents, at least the commission, this respondent, wants you to look at the entire language in 102.11.1e, and clearly not just the phrase things of value. There is important elements in that statute in addition to the phrase things of value. The one that Mr. Becker did touch on is obviously received, and I believe that that clearly in context has to be received by the employee in addition to monetary earnings. And picking up on Justice Prosser's question...
And is the premium not received by the employee?
We can't say that in all instances, Your Honor, because of the myriad ways that employers handle health insurance in this state. I think you know, for example, as a state employee, you and I basically get to choose from a panel of insurance.
And I never see the money, but it's clearly That's correct. My benefit.
Neither do I. That goes, for me, it goes directly to Unity HMO.
Mine goes right to the bank, so are you going to say that right. that isn't a right. thing of value that I've received?
Right. No, like I said, if I don't choose health insurance, in other words, I say my wife is working, for example, we're going to take the health insurance through her employer, I decline it through the state, I get no extra monetary benefit whatsoever. But you're aware that in these so-called cafeteria-style plans that a lot of private sector employees use, an employee is basically given a monthly amount of money, let's say $400, and the employer says, at your discretion, you choose among health insurance, child care expenses, da-da-da-da-da. If you don't choose any of those for some reason, the way I understand it is you get an extra $400 then added to your paycheck. And so that's a significant difference than the way mine is handled, for example.
Do you consider that extra $400 then part of the average wage?
Let me tell you what I want to ask you to, and that's why I'm saying please read the whole statute, because it says those are things that are received as part of the wage contract. That's why I think Justice Prosser's inquiry was so critical here. The legislature used the word wage contract in 1937, and I think they had a specific idea in mind when they used that phrase, because you're well aware of the fact that in 1911, when the statute came into effect, The definition of employee was every person in the service of another under any contract of hire. That's a very broad, expansive term. That's also the term that was used, or rather interpreted, by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Hillier case, which had been plucked directly from the New York State workers' comp law. It's also the phrase that's used in the recent Washington State Court decision in Cockle. In my view, Your Honor, there is clearly a difference to be made between a contract of hire, or the even more generic phrase, employment contract, and a wage contract, which is what the Wisconsin legislature used in 1937. And Justice Wilcox is absolutely correct. That language has not changed one iota in the six.
What is a wage contract?
A wage contract, Your Honor, is basically that part of your agreement or arrangement with the employer that tells how much you get in either salary or per hourly wage for doing your work. And it is clearly differentiated from that part of your employment contract, which is called the fringe benefit part. In other words, for example, my employment contract has a section and it's called wages and fringe benefits. And it goes through and it describes the pay ranges for employees, and then it goes through and it starts listing fringe benefits, health insurance, income continuation, vacation, sick leave. Those are all things that are part of the contract of hire or the employment contract, but I submit to you they're not part of the wage contract. That's a separate and distinct.
Yeah, but what does as a part of the wage contract mean? What does it define?
Okay, can I start? One thing, Your Honor, there's a 1928 decision from this court, a case called Miller and Rose versus Rich. It's at 195 Wisconsin 468, page 470. It talks about the history of the act starting in 1911 and the printed report that was put together, and I'm quoting from page 470 of that report. It says, quote, "All through the report, the idea is dominant that the Compensation Act was to cover laborers, workmen, employees, servants, wages." That's exactly what the legislature wanted to continue to do in 1937 when it put this statute into effect. They wanted to cover wages, those things received by the employee as part of the wage contract. And I think the best evidence, Your Honors, of what the legislature wanted to include in 1937 is the list in the department pamphlet, the footnote, that's footnote number 9. They talked about board, lodging, as Mr. Becker said, apprenticeship instruction. They also talked about any bonus, tip, or premium, part of the wage and reported by the employer in the first report of accident. And it refers to the old form, the A-12.
Is that the definition of thing of value or the definition of what's included in a wage contract?
I think, Your Honor, it's the definition of what that statute, the whole statute, was intended to include.
Mr. Sabota, you got to look at the whole thing in its entirety, and just a few words preceding wage contract is monetary earnings. When anything of value are received in addition to monetary earnings as part of the wage contract. Well, you're saying that the wage contract comprises the only part of it is monetary earnings.
Oh, I'm sorry, Anna, if I gave you that impression, I misspoke, because it clearly is intended to include then things like board, lodging, apprenticeship instruction. Those things are not necessarily received, you know, in your paycheck, so to speak.
But how do you know that? That just sounds like 1930s or 1911 kind of contract.
Right.
Oh, but But a statute speaks today.
Right.
It speaks generally.
Absolutely.
It speaks to changing circumstances.
Right.
So why are we down to leaving it at board, lodging, and apprenticeship when today board, lodging, apprenticeship may or may not be things of value that are generally received when we do have medical coverage, retirement, et cetera, all of which are very important. The legislature doesn't have to amend this every time circumstances change. There's a general concept here.
Right. They clearly don't, Your Honor, and I think the case that tells us exactly why this isn't for this court to do that is in Transamerica Insurance Company, 54 West 2nd, 272 at 279, quote, "We do not join the discussion, pro or con, on the public policy aspects of the dispute. Ours is the more limited function of applying the law as it is, irrespective of whether we consider the policy underlying the law to be good policy or bad policy. And I submit that the role of this court, as the role of most of the majority of the courts across the country that have looked at this, is that this is a very expensive, complex change in the dynamics of the Workers' Compensation Act. And the proper body to hear both sides of the story, employees and employers, and to kind of sift and winnow and find out what the public policy for the state of Wisconsin should be, is we're lucky in Wisconsin, we have the filter of the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. It goes through them first, but ultimately it goes to the legislature. And the legislature can decide what's good public policy and what things should be included. And when Your Honor asked the question about, well, where do we draw the line in this type of case? I submit that you can draw the line very easily. I don't want you, though, to do what the Washington Supreme Court did in the Cockle decision, and I'm talking about the majority, when they, at the end of that decision, wrote this so-called rule where it talked about core value fringe benefits that, you know, go toward the direct health and safety. That's not a rule at all. That offers no guidance to administrative agencies and practitioners. If this court wants to look at a statute and a one from a sister state of ours that handles this matter very easily, could I call the court's attention to the decision of the North Dakota Supreme Court in Lucier, L-U-C-I-E-R, versus North Dakota Workers' Comp Bureau. That's at 556 Northwest 2nd 56, a 1996 decision of that court. They refer to a statute that was passed by the North Dakota legislature in 1993 in the footnote number 1, and this is the definition of wages that North Dakota settled on. Quote, "Wages means an employee's remuneration from all employment reportable by employers to the Internal Revenue Service as earned income for federal income tax purposes and lost as the result of the compensable work injury."
Counsel, that's the problem that I have with this case, and I think I alluded to it in questions to your opposing counsel. I think the Workers' Comp Advisory Board is just great. It's marvelous. And maybe the Workers' Comp Advisory, maybe your definition, the definition of the department is reasonable, makes sense, you know, it's kind of a nice middle ground, and what's the advisory board established for after all, but to get consensus in a middle ground. Now, the problem is the wording of this statute. You're suggesting that the legislature intended, by your interpretation, to use the federal tax code to define what benefits are available in a statutory workers' compensation scheme. And that is beyond belief to me.
Let me, again, clarify, Your Honor, that so-called index as far as a measuring stick was indeed alluded to in the commission decision, saying that these are things that are for the most part not included as taxable, but that's not a test as is in this North Dakota statute.
I know, I heard you read North Dakota. Right. I say to you, boy, if I were the legislature or if I were making this rule, sounds reasonable to me, and I think I'd write it in. You know, if it's taxable, fine. But when I'm looking at this, the words of this statute and what was intended by the legislature in 1937, I don't think that there's anything to show that they intended that the federal tax code should be used to define workers' compensation benefits based on a Wisconsin statute. Just doesn't happen.
I agree with that assessment, Your Honor, but I also want you to tell you know from the briefs that the advent of fringe benefits across the country basically started in apparently the late 1940s, early 1950s. And so to the extent that the legislature in 1937 was even thinking about the so-called modern day list of fringe benefits, I don't think they were. But the key for us to follow for a guide here is what has the department and the commission done consistently since 1956.
Well, I don't think that is the key, because if the commission and the advisory board and the commission's interpretation has come to a reasonable interpretation, but it's more limiting and inconsistent with the clear language of the statute, I don't think you can give deference to something that limits rights given by the statute. That's the argument, anyway.
I understand the argument, Your Honor, but I obviously have to respectfully disagree with that, because you've told us in no uncertain terms that the rule in this state is that a statutory provision is ambiguous if reasonable minds could differ as to its meaning. And I guess I'd be puzzled if you told me that looking at the cases across the country, I think the latest score is 15 in the majority, and with Washington, 6 in the minority, that reasonable minds couldn't differ about the meaning of this statute.
Chief, may I? Do you think reasonable, it seems to me that you would concede that a benefit of health insurance is a thing of value.
Yeah, see, that's what Mr. Becker is trying to pin us down to, is to only looking at the words things of value. But in Morales, this court told us again, don't look at a statute or a single isolated sentence or a portion of a sentence, but look at the role of the relevant language in the entire statute.
Well, what you've pointed to, as I understand it, is that it is really this phrase, wage contract, that is maybe ambiguous, what's meant by a wage contract. Am I wrong? Okay.
Right, yeah, because, see, again, I don't want you to look at either the phrase things of value, I don't want you to look at received by the employee, I don't want you to look at just wage contract, I want you to look at the entire statute as enacted in 1937, totally unchanged for 63 years, and consistently interpreted by my agency to mean fringe benefits are not included. That's what I want this court to look at, and I would respectfully, under the recent cases, ask for great weight deference for my commission's interpretation. And I think that's only fair that we've met the four tests, and Mr. Becker has not convinced me that this is, number one, a case for de novo review, nor has he convinced me that this is even a middle ground case, which is what Judge Krewal gave it in Racine County. This is a great weight deference interpretation case.
You've got a manual since 56, so between 37 and 56, we don't know what you did.
Mr. Becker asked me about that, Your Honor, and I can tell you, and here's the way the history of this thing has developed. The 56 manual is the first so-called written thing I was able to find where there was a formal policy. That manual was amended in 1966. The language was verbatim, the same thing. Mr. Soxie apparently has a more recent, I don't know if we even call it a pamphlet, because apparently it's more just a series of loose leaf pages from the Department of Workforce Development, and that's the one that's actually cited in the commission decision. But then even more important than that, Your Honor, look at the Dennis and Neal handbook, which is basically the Bible in Wisconsin workers' comp law. They clearly say that's the interpretation. So I don't think Mr. Becker is seriously challenging the fact that that interpretation has not been one of long-standing and consistent. I think it clearly has been.
No challenges other than the ones
that Mr. Becker has included in the
no
brief,
challenge.
Which were ALJ decisions and not commission decisions.
And that Bible, as you refer to, indicates that the department has things of values given as part of a wage contract must be valued, etc., by long-standing administrative interpretation, fringe benefits have never been valued and added to the wage, and that's what you're referring to.
Right.
And then it goes on to say, note, although employer-paid health insurance may be a substantial part of a compensation package, no published decisions have determined that they should be included in the calculation of average weekly wage.
That's correct, Your Honor. The issue
that we have before us, right. This Bible says is...
It's clearly a case of first impression for a Wisconsin appellate court, no question about that, and I'm sure that's why this court took it on certification from the Court of Appeals. It is an important workers' compensation case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Mr. Svoboda, do you have any idea of how much extra insurance it would cost?
I don't know about extra insurance, Your Honor, but one thing that I thought the court might be interested in knowing is I checked with DWD as far as what percentage of workers in the Wisconsin workforce are below maximum wage. And I think their statistics are probably about 2 years old, but they said the figure has been pretty consistent that 80% of workers are below max for workers' comp purposes. So that's a fairly significant figure, obviously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert Akowitz, and I represent Gatton Technologies and North River Insurance Company in this case. I would briefly like to touch on the implications of this case, if you rule in the applicant's favor, is that, like Mr. Becker, I've been practicing 16 and a half years in this business. I've never had a wage issue go to hearing. This is the first one. But potentially every case that's still within the 12-year statute of limitations for workers' compensation cases that are below the maximum wage could be opened up, and the issue then would be what is the thing of value and what is the value of that thing and what is the wage contract on this. And it touches somewhat what you were saying, Justice Bradley, about then we decide where do you cut off what is a thing of value. Is it just health insurance premiums? Is it free parking that we give employees? Is it child care expenses? Is it the office I sit in, the telephone that they give me, the computer? Those are all things of value, clearly, to me as a practicing lawyer. And the question is, at what point do you cut that off? I think that when you look at the statute in a whole, it's the whole 102.11 is defined as method of calculation of earnings. And earnings
clearly, in my mind, is what is taxable. And if this is not taxable, the health insurance premiums that the employer pays is not taxable under the federal code, 25 U.S.C. 106, I believe it is. And as a result of not being taxable, I think if you look at items that are taxable or not, you get a better idea of what things should be included, is what the legislature intended as part of this statute. If you isolate, as Mr. Sabota said, as Mr. Becker is contending, just on the issue of the thing of value, then clearly this is a health insurance premium, is a thing of value. But taken in the whole context, it's ambiguous as to whether health insurance premiums are a thing of value in addition to monetary earnings under a wage contract. And as far as other cases that in the future, is again, this would be one of the things that we'd be debating on these things, is what is a thing of value if it's not, in this specific case, it's health insurance premiums. But applicants' lawyers such as Mr. Becker and other people are clever people, and they're going to push the envelope as to what should be considered. And if we don't have some idea as to what is a thing of value, such as taxable items, which I think is the most logical conclusion from this, from the reading of the statute, is that you're going to have that issue come up every time in the things that I enumerated. And then what is the value for certain things, such as I have to be candid with health insurance premiums. Initially, when this came up, I thought it would be difficult to calculate, but it is possible to calculate. But these other things that I've mentioned, is, I think, would be much more difficult to calculate as to what is the value of that.
Now, what would your position be if this tax plan that is proposed to give a huge decrease also had increases in it, so that we would tax people on premiums paid by their employer? Because it is a benefit, it is money, it's if they gave you cash and you spent it. So would that change the workers' comp rules in this state?
I think it would. I think you'd be consistent with my argument. I think it would have to be, because then it would be, in my opinion, consistent with earnings, because it is something that is taxable now. To be consistent, I would say, yes, that would change the position. But as of right now, that is not the case, and that's clearly what we have in this case, is it's not taxable.
So if you had a retirement income program that wasn't qualified under the tax laws, you'd say, and therefore you would be taxed, the employee would be taxed on any contribution, you'd say that would go in for workers' comp, too.
Is it not qualified because there's some screw-up by the employer, or simply because it doesn't qualify under the plan? Well, I would look at it as if it's reported as earnings to the IRS, yes, then it would be consistent. If it's not, no. If it's something that I get either in a W-2 or some type of form that I report on my income tax returns.
So it's W-2 money.
I would say that there's other ways to get it, 1099s, things like that, but it's something where I have to put on my tax return, send to the state and the federal government. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is the, if you rule in this case, in these prior cases, or prior cases are reopened, right now, it's been a long-standing tradition and interpretation that this is not a benefit to health insurance premiums. The insurance companies have not had an opportunity to collect any type of premium for that exposure that's out there. Obviously, that would not be the case in the future, but in the past, they do not have that opportunity. And I do think that another policy implication of this is, as Mr. Sabota mentioned, about 80%, and I'm assuming that figure is accurate, 80% of the people are below the maximum wage, and unfortunately in this society, a lot of them at the lower end of the wage are the ones without health insurance, small employers, things like that, and this does not give them any incentive to get health insurance for their people if they now have this increased exposure based upon the wages and also the increased workers' comp premiums that it would inevitably follow from a decision in favor of the applicant. I agree with Mr. Sabota that I think it's the great weight standard of review on this, because two administrative law judge decisions, one of, I know was compromised before it was determined by LIRC, and the other one I'm not sure about. But in other words, we don't have a LIRC decision on this. And I think at worst, the standard of review would be the one in Morales, which would be the due weight, because there you did have a LIRC decision that was inconsistent. And in that, the standard ultimately became, is there a more reasonable approach to this? And Mr. Becker's own words were, both of them, you know, our interpretation, the LIRC interpretation was reasonable, his is interpreted. He didn't say that, it, you know, theirs, I mean, that his interpretation is more reasonable. So under either standard, I think the LIRC decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Counsel, before you sit down, the statute. When anything of value, things of value are received in addition to monetary earnings as part of a wage contract. If the definition of wage contract is, as your opposing counsel indicates, in other words, every employer has a wage contract, whether it's written or not written, that's the terms of the agreement of employment, I think, you know. If that's the definition of wage contract, then do you lose?
No, because it's more than, there, as I mentioned, one of the ambiguities, I believe, when you read the statute in context, is what is the thing of value? And
well, maybe that's the ambiguity, but in a broader scope, but I find it hard to think that someone paying my health insurance premium isn't a thing of value. I mean, a health insurance benefit is certainly a thing of value. People stay married rather than get divorced because they're concerned about their health insurance coverage. You know, health insurance is an immense thing of value these days.
I have no dispute with any of that.
Yeah.
However, again, it's in the context of the entire statute. Is it a thing of value which should be considered an earning, which should be kept part of the calculation of the average weekly wage?
I'm missing something, because I know both you and Mr. Sabota are very smart, and that both of you are saying, well, it's in the context of the whole thing, that it's ambiguous. But I'm just having, other than saying, well, maybe a wage contract is ambiguous, when anything of value, things of value, are received in addition to money, as part of the wage contract.
Well, I guess the way I would look at it is when I talk to my wife, or she's talking to me, or a family member, or someone, you know, that we're intimate with as far as knowledge we're going to share about our finances or salaries, I never include, when I talk to my wife, I'm going to get paid X amount, and as part of my earnings are my 401k, my whatever. I never include that. I tell her my earnings are X, or they tell me that. We never include that. That's a fringe benefit, and sure, it's a thing of value, but it's not part of my earnings, and I don't know how
it's
you...
It's not part of your wage contract. Is that what you're saying?
It could be both. I would agree in the whole context of the statute. It's not a thing of value as part of the wage contract.
Because a thing of value in addition to money, you're saying you think money is the only thing you include, but the words of the statute are saying a thing of value is something in addition to monetary.
Not necessarily money. I think that's why it comes to taxable income. I think that's a clear line. For instance, if I get a car from my employer, the business-related part is not taxable. However, my personal use is taxable, and that would be considered part of earnings. So that is not a monetary, I'm not getting cash for it, but I am getting a thing of value that is taxable, that is part of my wage contract. So that clearly fits within the parameters of what we're talking about. But his statement, he made the comment at page 17 of his brief to the Court of Appeals where he said, well, the defendants talk about gold watches and company picnics and Christmas parties are not part of this because they're exercised at the discretion of the employer. However, when I started employment, I never negotiated the health package or things like that. Those were fringe benefits. The only thing I negotiated was my wage, and it was not I didn't negotiate the fringe benefit.
That's the excesses of youth when you get older. You
thank you for your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Akowitz. Mr. Soxie, representing Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Your colleagues were kind enough to allow you 5 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm William R. Soxie, Jr. My client today is the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and amicus curiae in this matter. They've asked me to make a couple of quick points to you. Number one, I think it's very important to understand that we are talking about calculating the average weekly wage. And the plain meaning of wage to most citizens in this country is their salary. Their hourly pay, their salary, their commission, and what the government taxes. If you ask them about the other things, they talk about benefits. And we've been discussing today what is meant by wage contract, and I think that that term, as it was understood in 1937 and as it ought to be understood today, really reflects the taxable wages paid to an employee. A collective bargaining agreement, which is a contract between employers and employees, governs the conditions of the workplace and goes way beyond wages. It includes the benefits that we're discussing today. It includes when shifts will start and end, what sort of work will be performed during those shifts, sick leave rules, all sorts of work rules that have nothing to do with the compensation package that the employee receives, either taxable or otherwise. So I think the term wage contract, as it was understood then and can be understood today, reflects taxable wages, and that the department's interpretation and the commission's interpretation is a reasonable one. It's also important to us to make the point, Justices and Chief Justice Abrahamson, that the Advisory Council on Workers' Compensation, which drafted this legislation and meets regularly throughout the 60-plus years that it's been in existence, has been watching over the system of compensation and has not sought to change the Workers' Compensation Division and the Commission's interpretation of this regulation. And the Council is a very important body in this law. It's unique. There's, as far as I know, other than perhaps unemployment compensation in this state, there's no other such system. And we're not aware of any other system in any other state of the Union. And we're told by people who study our system that we have a model system, and we believe in the WMC that the Advisory Council is largely the reason that we do. And that's because it's five labor and five business representatives. The only other person with a vote on the council is the administrator of the Workers' Comp Division, and traditionally she does not exercise her vote to break or force ties. That means we have collective bargaining over the terms of the Workers' Compensation Act. And just like in a factory, where it's important to balance the interests of labor and management so that it's fair to both sides, it's important that in our act, those interests are also balanced. And when the judiciary makes a dramatic change in the interpretation of the act without there being collective bargaining, it has the danger of breaking the system. And we would like to avoid that as much as possible. When this act was passed in 1911, the term quid pro quo was used. At the time, employers gave up various what we would call contributory negligence type defenses in exchange for employees obtaining a no-fault benefit. And that was a quid pro quo that started this process. And through the years, the Advisory Council, when it's been successful, has been able to negotiate and use the quid pro quo theory in order to make changes in the act.
How is Chapter 102 to be construed?
Pardon me?
How is Chapter 102 to be interpreted? Isn't there language that says it's to be interpreted in a...
How is it originally interpreted?
No. There's statutory interpretation language that usually might say something like this. It should be interpreted liberally for the benefit of workers. Does that say that in 102?
I think what the liberal interpretation statutes mean, Chief Justice Abrahamson, or rules in the courts mean, is that when it's fair to interpret a provision in favor of the employee, that it's okay to do so. But that making a dramatic change that is outside what might have been intended by the legislature, that you're going beyond. a quote from the General Castings case perhaps is important here. Whether the statute should be further expanded to cover the employee situation is a matter of public policy for the legislature. It is not one for us to judicially legislate. There's a difference between interpreting and legislating. We believe that in this situation, it would be legislating.
What is the statutory support for tying the determination to taxability? Why wouldn't we just say
The word taxable doesn't appear in Section 102.11 in all justice sites. Right. I think the support for it is the use of the word wage, which was at the time that this statute was passed, what was taxable. And the items that are added in the footnote were also items that were taxable. So I think the Workers' Comp Division at the time had to take a leap. And the leap was to look at what the legislature instructed them to include at the time and to draw the inference that that meant taxable benefits. And they've been saying that, we know, at least since 1956, and the members of the Advisory Council have not seen fit to force a change or ask the legislature to force a change on the Workers' Comp Division or the Commission.
So at the time the statute was passed, your argument is that the term wage or wage contract was understood to mean that which is taxable?
Yes, and that is exactly what I believe it meant to these men and women who drafted this statute at the time. They were looking at taxable benefits, and I think all those items that are enumerated in the footnote were subject to tax at that time.
Mr. Soxie, your co-counsel spoke about the possibility of reopening many of the things where the statute of limitations did not run. You also talked about premium costs.
This is the question you had before, I think, which is what's the effect if this changes goes through?
What's the handle on the premiums?
The annual premium?
No. What handle do you have on the cost of the increased cost of premiums for the business community?
Well, if Mr. Toyer prevails on his argument here, his average weekly wage will be increased by about 28%. Since workers' compensation premiums are based on an employer's payroll, if the payroll of this particular employer is increased by 28%, the premiums are likely to also increase by 28%. And that would be the effect on any employer in the state that has a health insurance plan that increases the value of a wage, so to speak, by a certain percentage. Each employer's plans, I think we've learned today, are different. Some pay more, some pay less. But since payroll is the basis of a workers' compensation premium, and if you choose to define health insurance contributions as payroll, then the premiums are going to go up. The problem that we're going to experience is that we have a 12-year limitation statute in this state, and it's not from the date of injury, it's from the last payment of compensation. So there are some cases that are longer than 12 years old, and what's going to happen is any of those men or women who had health insurance at the time of their injury can reopen their cases and ask for an increase in benefits. And no premium has been collected from those employers to reflect that increased obligation. If those employers are self-insured, that comes directly off the bottom line. And I think all of us in here know that employers don't pay those premiums. The citizens of this state, the consumers of their products and services, pay those premiums. And so ultimately the bill will pass down to the citizens of the state. What the WMC would like to see is, if we're going to change this, let's take a look at how many employers offer this premium, how many are willing to continue it during the disability period, what is the value of this, what would the impact be on premiums, would employers stop offering this benefit if their workers' compensation premiums were increased, bring that to the table with labor and management, and see if we can't work out a compromise that passes along the costs as was intended by the framers of the statute in 1911 and be fair to employees at the same time. We need to get labor to the bargaining table on that.
Thank you, Mr. Soxie. Mr. Becker, you have 5 minutes.
A few things I'd like to respond to what has been said. First, I'd like to address one of the things Mr. Soxie just said, suggesting that premiums may go up 28% because his TTD would go up 28%. That would not happen. I mean, I don't have the numbers, but First of all, as I think what Mr. Sabota said, that 80% or 20% of the people are already at the maximum wage, so it's not going to increase their TTD. Of the 80% that are below that, there's many that don't have health insurance, and the premium isn't based just on TTD. It's not going to change medical expense, which, as I understand, is the major portion of the major cost of workers' comp. It's not even the temporary or total disability benefits, and the PPD wouldn't change. So it's not going to increase benefits or premiums by 28%. I mean, it just would be impossible. What, after reading the briefs and hearing what they had to say today, what it seems to be what these three are saying is that the statute means taxable benefits. I didn't hear any arguments that the health insurance wasn't received. There was an argument in the AG's brief. I'll briefly address that. I mean, if I bought insurance from an agency and went back a year later and said I want my money back because I never received the insurance, they'd laugh at me. To suggest that the employee didn't receive insurance is really nonsense. But again, what their argument seems to boil down to here is that it should be taxable. The statute doesn't say taxable. It could very easily have done that. It doesn't say when things of value that are taxable are received. And it even says, the second half, when it talks about when things of value are received, in addition to monetary earnings, they are deemed a part of earnings. That suggests that you're going to get non-taxable benefits. But whether it's suggested or not, the statute clearly doesn't say that. It could have very easily limited the benefits here to taxable.
What's the significance of the word wage next to contract in the statute? The statute doesn't say things of value received as a part of the employment contract or the compensation package, et cetera. It says wage contract. Does that have any significance to you?
No. I think wage contract is part of the employment contract.
Well, it's part of it, but
right.
Not the whole thing.
Correct. Now, Mr. Akowitz says that when he got his job, he didn't ask about fringe benefits. Well, I hired Mr. Durkin about 4 months ago, and I guarantee you that was a topic of discussion. Not too many people nowadays say, go into a job saying, how much are you going to pay me, and not care about anything else. It is something that's bargained for.
As a part of your total compensation package, but
right.
That doesn't help us,
I guess,
construe the phrase wage contract in the total context of this statute.
Well, I guess the way I would read it, wage contract certainly includes any compensation.
So you think it includes everything?
Includes compensation for your services.
So
whatever you are receiving in compensation for your services.
So it's the equivalent of the entire compensation package. Wage contract should mean, and if you were writing this opinion, you'd write it to say wage contract means the entire compensation package or the entire employment contract.
Yes. I believe as Mr. Sabota even suggested, it does go beyond monetary earnings. If that's the case, you know, you can't read the statute without drawing the line somewhere without the statute being ambiguous. If you read it their way, the statute's ambiguous. If you say, well, we don't know what this means, we don't know what thing of value means, we don't know what wage contract means. But if you just read it in English, I mean, if a non-lawyer or a non-judge read this, they'd look at it and say, a thing of value in addition to your earnings, health insurance is a thing of value. I mean,
Counsel.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I know what you mean, and I mean, it's a persuasive argument because the language on its face appears so clear, certainly to a layperson. And yet, you know, one of the things that we seek to do in interpreting laws, et cetera, is to provide reliability and predictability for people who must go into the economic marketplace out there and do their things. And also in the law, custom and usage, once it's been around long enough, takes on a certain weight in those interpretations, and particularly a weight in terms of people conducting their daily affairs in reliance upon what has gone on in the past. So, I look at this and I say, man, you know, there have been, 40 years of it that this has been interpreted. This has never come before this court. Collective bargaining has gone on at myriads of businesses across this country for years, and apparently has not been addressed, or at least it's not been brought to the attention of the court, but it's been addressed. And you're asking us to really upset a pretty big apple cart with what you're saying. Now, if you were writing the opinion and I had to respond to a very sharply worded dissent that said exactly what I've just said, how would you respond?
Well, I understand the department may not like their wage computations complicated. But I think Justice Marshall in his dissent said, well, you have to be roughly, it's better to be roughly right than totally wrong. In 1937, the statute was passed.
Roughly, he said
it
roughly right.
It's better to be roughly right than totally wrong. So, see, it may be hard sometimes to compute these benefits, but in 1937, when this was the statute was passed, I think the statute was pretty clear. 20 years later, they do have their workbook or whatever, and they come up with their interpretation. And again, there's never been enough at stake, probably, for any individual to challenge it. The defendants even concede that health insurance wasn't a big deal until recently. I think everybody's aware that in the last 10 or 15 years, it's become a much bigger part of most wage compensations or wage packages. And again, even in this case, even we're talking $3,600 for each individual employee by themselves. It's not a big deal. But when an employee is living from paycheck to paycheck, maybe we don't live that way, but a lot of these employees do. That is a lot of money for them. And to have their health insurance cut off because they're getting cut $150, because that's what their premiums would be, it's a lot of money for them. That is a big deal for them. And again, because the department, 20 years after the statute was passed, put this into their workbook because they didn't want to go through the calculations, is no reason to continue it, I guess. I guess that's how I respond to it. I mean, the statute says what it says. And they've never been challenged with it because there's never maybe been enough in dispute for anybody individually to bring it up.
And thank you, Mr. Becker. Thank you, Mr. Sabota. I'm going to thank you for your oral argument. That closes our argument on 00-1085. Employee versus Lurk, and we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. Council would approach the desk, please.